What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
Why do Catholics worship Mary?
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
Where is purgatory in the Bible?
What's stopping you?
I think the Pope has too much authority.
What's stopping you? You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey everybody, welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN, a unique program in not only Catholic broadcasting, but all of broadcasting. This program is for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, but you don't know where to get that question answered, we are here for you. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're listening to us in Kenya, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. And of course, you can always send us an email. The address for that, ctc@ewtn.com. That's the best way to contact the show if you're watching us on TV today. Again, ctc@ewtn.com. Charles Beery is our producer. Matt Kabinski is our phone screener. Rich Jesse handles social media for us. If you would like to ask a question via YouTube or Facebook, we are streaming on both those platforms right now. Just put your question in the comments box if you would. Rich will see that. He'll shoot it to us here in Radio Studio One, and we are off to the races, hopefully getting that question answered on today's program. Again, the phone number, 833-288-EWTN. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I am great. How are you?
I'm doing decent. Thank you.
Interesting objection we received from a fellow named Tom, who says, can you explain how evangelicals justify dismissing, quote, upon this rock I will build my church, and this is my body, and yet believe in sola scriptura?
Yeah, sure. I really appreciate the question. So just so people who are listening to the show will understand the context, the upon this rock is part of the text of Matthew 16 where Christ establishes the papacy on the rock of St. Peter.
Mm-hmm.
Peter, who went by the whose name was Simon, and Jesus changes his name to Peter, and there's really not much in the way of a precedent for that as a personal name. Petra, of course, means rock in Greek, and so he says, okay, your name is Rocky now, basically, Simon, and on this rock I'm going to build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it, and I give to you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth is bound in heaven, whatever you loose on earth is loosed in heaven. So three distinct metaphors. He sets Peter aside from the other apostles. One, he gets this name change to be the rock foundation of the church's unity.
Mm-hmm.
Two, he has the power of the keys, which is a symbol of executive authority. And three, he has this power of binding and loosing, which in rabbinic Judaism was the power to admit or exclude, declare things clean or unclean. So Peter, pretty important guy.
Yeah.
And our caller wants to know, how is it that non-Catholics, like evangelical Protestants, can read that and not see the papacy? Well, here's how they do it. Now, this is kind of funny because I'm supposed to be defending the Catholic Church, and you're asking me to give you an argument against it, but I'll answer the question.
Okay.
So I used to be an evangelical Protestant, and when I read Matthew 16, I wasn't particularly swayed by it, and I didn't want to become Catholic in consequence. And the reason why is twofold. First of all, the traditional Protestant way of reading that text is to say that the rock on which Christ builds the church is something other than Peter. You look at that and you go, do what? Right? I mean, doesn't the grammar of the text seem to suggest almost inevitably that Peter is the referent on this rock? And in fact, it does. And so I never found that as a Protestant. I never found that position persuasive. But lots of Protestants will say that. They'll say that Peter's not actually the rock. It's something else. It's Peter's faith. It's his confession. It's Jesus himself, but it's not Peter. I never found that persuasive as a Protestant. And many don't. I mean, there was a very well-known New Testament professor at my seminary who wrote an article about St. Peter in a book of Christian history that I have on my bookshelf, and he said, look, Peter's obviously the rock. The grammar says he's the rock. So the other move was to say, okay, so Peter has a foundational role among the apostles, but there's no biblical evidence, so would argue the Protestant, that this office transfers to his successors, the bishops of Rome. And so it's a unique one-off thing for Peter, but there are no popes that follow from that. That's probably what I would have held when I was a Protestant.
Okay,
so Peter's an important guy, but that doesn't mean the Pope is on the rock of St. Peter. And as far as it goes, I would say, okay, so the scriptures itself don't explicitly mention the establishment of the papacy in Rome and the specific Petrine succession. However, that's the way Christians have read the text for 2,000 years. Those to whom it was written, for whom it was written, the earliest generations of Christians all understood the text that way. If you read the text within the mind and the habits of the Christian faith for 2,000 years, then there is an obvious reference, then it's the Bishop of Rome. And the fact that early Christians disputed about all kinds of things, but nobody disputed that Rome was, in fact, the heir of St. Peter's See. That went undisputed. So okay. You do have to admit the principle of sacred tradition to get all the way to the Catholic position. But, hey, you need Catholic tradition to even recognize that Matthew's part of the Bible.
Yeah. And what about this is my body?
Oh, yeah. Okay, same thing. So, well, not same thing, similar. Luther, who, of course, was the foundation of Protestantism, he absolutely believed in the doctrine of the royal presence. He doesn't hold it the way Catholics hold it, but Luther definitely believed in the doctrine of the real presence. John Calvin, the other major reformer of the 16th century, again, he didn't hold the Lutheran position, he didn't hold the Catholic position, but he did hold that partaking in the Eucharist was a substantial partaking in the body and blood of Christ. Now, he has a novel theory about how that works, but he continued to believe in a version of the doctrine of the real presence. But most Protestants today, at least on this side of the Atlantic, and those that are not Lutherans, do not. And they simply say, well, Jesus meant these words in a merely symbolic way. There's no kind of metaphysical change that takes place in the elements. And there is no textual basis for that position. It's just an assertion.
Okay. And assertions can be combated very
simply. Can be disputed, yep.
All right, very good. And one quick one here from Denny. I know it's a dogma that we believe that God has no emotions. How do I explain to my non-Catholic wife that this is true, but God's sacred heart can break according to the scriptures?
Well, so the scriptures clearly ascribe emotion to God, as does Catholic devotional tradition, all right? The question is, how are you to understand that language?
Mm-hmm.
And what Catholic tradition tells you is that kind of language is figurative. It is an accommodation to our mode of speech, but it falls short of really capturing the essence of God himself.
Okay, very good. Denny, thank you so much for your email. We also thank Tom for his question that we got to a little bit earlier in the hour. In a moment, we're going to go to Trinidad and talk with Andre. Also, Taylor, a first-time caller from Manchester, New Hampshire. A couple lines open for you as well at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. It's called A Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Do stay with us. Hey, glad you're with us for A Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN, beginning with Taylor, a first-time caller from Manchester, New Hampshire, listening on the EWTN app. Hey there, Taylor, what's on your mind today?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a candidate preparing for confirmation. You guys have been really helpful in prepping for that, so I appreciate it.
Great.
Something that I have really grown to love about the church that's so different from my Protestant background is the presence of all seven sacraments, but I get a little confused in relation to Orthodoxy, and so my question is, how does the Orthodox Church retain apostolic succession and all seven sacraments while being in schism with the Catholic Church?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So valid ordination does not require that a person be in unity with the Pope. So a priest doesn't lose his priesthood if he enters into schism, right? Because it's like baptism, ordination is something that's imprinted upon the soul, right? Mm-hmm. And a bishop who's a validly ordained bishop is a validly ordained bishop, whatever else he does in life. And he'd go to hell and be a validly ordained bishop. And one of the things that's impressed upon the soul through valid ordination is the ability to confer ordination. Episcopal ordination conveys the ability to confer ordination. So he can validly confer ordination upon another man, provided he has the proper intent and the proper form. And so that's always been the case in the church, and there have always been groups that have broken away from Catholic unity. And sometimes, see, if they come back, those people would not be ordained again. Mm. Right? It's not like they lose their power of ordination because of the schism. They've just, you know, it's a wound against the church's unity. But they, you know, they belong to it in a very intimate and mystical way. And so, you know, that act of reunion is the natural one to make.
Okay. Is that helpful for you, Taylor?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
You are welcome, and very glad that you're in the RCIA program. Thanks so much for your call. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, or perhaps you would like to explain what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic. Again, 833-288-EWTN. Let's go to Trinidad now and talk with Andre watching us on YouTube. Hey there, Andre. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hi, Tom and Dr. Anders. Happy Lent.
Thank you.
Dr. Anders, my sister told me she attended a retreat at my parish last week where a member of the Catholic clergy preached on generational curses. She told me she found that talk quite helpful. She is, of course, nominally Catholic, but has followed Protestant evangelicals most of her adult life. I told her, from what I know, the church doesn't teach the idea of generational curses. And in fact, they had just written an article to demonstrate that general curses are not a Catholic teaching, according to senior apologist Jimmy Akin, who, in explaining the nature of original sin, says that we are not personally responsible for our ancestors' sins. He quotes Jeremiah 31, verses 29 to 38, and Ezekiel 18 to support his argument. Also, I heard Father Robert Spitzer on EWTN categorically deny the church teaches this idea. Am I missing something here? Can you clarify? And thanks for taking my call.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the question. It's always good to hear from you as well. So you are correct in your assessment of the situation. There are a few other things we could add that I think would strengthen the position you've taken. One is that in 2018, the International Society of Catholic Exorcists held a specific study session on this very issue. And concluded definitively that this whole idea of generational curses or generational sin is not part of the Catholic tradition. And you don't find it anywhere in any Catholic exorcist or demonologist or spiritual theologian until the 20th century. And the origin of the idea lies in Pentecostal Protestantism. And so it shouldn't be part of Catholic liturgical or devotional rites. It's not part of the tradition. It is an import from another tradition, and it's not part of our healthy spiritual practice.
Andre, thank you so much for your call today from Trinidad. I have this great vision of our friend Andre, who calls in from time to time. Always good to hear from him. I have this vision of him sitting on the beach in you know, one of those beach chairs, watching, you know, us on YouTube with a yellow pad, and he's taking everything down that we do, that, The Journey Home does, all these other programs. He is a very literate guy.
Yeah, very thorough. Very,
very thorough. Indeed. Andre, keep up the good work. Appreciate hearing from you today on Call to Communion. Our phone number again, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Parsevance is a first-time caller from Cincinnati watching us on TV today. Hey there, what's on your mind today?
Hi. Yeah, the positive nature of the Catholic Church needs to be engaged much, much more, I think. Lent is a time of reflection and sacrifice, giving things up. Come on, put the reins on, yeah, during Lent. But after Lent, we need Christ off that cross. He doesn't need to be on there suffering. Why do we want to adore suffering, which is what's happening? And God gave it, take up your cross. What he gave was ampersand, positive, horizontal, vertical goodness and righteousness that is very important to keep it lifted up and not put us into a depression, which is what, you know, being able to do, they are.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate that perspective. Thank you so much for calling and asking these questions. So let me give you a thought about that in the Catholic tradition. So if I lived the life that Mary lived, I'd be depressed out of my gourd. Right? Because think about it. I'm 13, 14 years old, and angel shows up and says, so here's what's going to happen to you. You know, you're going to marry this fellow who's a lot older than you are, and you're going to have a child with him, even though you weren't expecting that. And probably the people around you are going to think you are up to something, right? Because it's going to be a miraculous birth.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be found with child before you've come together. And you know what the neighbors are going to say about that.
Yeah.
Shortly after his birth, the king's going to try and kill you all, or at least kill your baby.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to have to get up and immigrate to Egypt, where you don't know anybody, you don't speak the language. Be there for a while, all right? That's going to be a lot of hardship. And keep in mind, like, we're not taking Amtrak or Delta Airlines over there. We're going to, you know, truck through the desert to get there, and who knows how we're going to make our way. You know, when you come back, your son is going to begin a public ministry when the authorities will be out for his head, and he will die in ignominy, the death of torture. And by that time, you're likely to be a widow. And you'll spend the rest of your life, you know, having watched your son tortured to death, you know, living with your nephew in poverty. Like, most people would not say, sign me up, right? But her response is, be it done to me according to thy word. When people came to Christ and said, hey, I want to follow you, his response was, foxes have holes. The birds of the air have nests. I don't have any place to lay my head, right? I have not come to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. And he fasted for long periods of time. When he did go out and party, which he did, most people looked down on it, said, hey, he's hanging out with tax collectors and sinners, and they didn't treat him very well with that. And, of course, it ultimately ended in his crucifixion. Christ, he didn't have a human family. He didn't have any place to lay his head. His whole life was one of abnegation. Now, he doesn't come across in the Gospels as sad, but he does come across as having lived a life of deep asceticism and terrible hardship.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right that the Gospels don't depict the inner life of Jesus and Mary as particularly troubled by that. They're utterly committed to doing the will of God, but they're committed to doing it in the midst of terrible, terrible deprivation. St. Paul, who recounts his own sufferings for the sake of the gospel, it's immense. I mean, the number of times he was arrested or beaten, thrown in prison, stoned, left for dead, shipwrecked, you know, went days and nights in the open sea without food, without shelter, without friends.
Mm-hmm.
It was unbelievable. And, of course, he also is killed. He's martyred for his faith. A life of really, really difficult abnegation. Why doesn't he come across as an Eeyore or a sourpuss? And that's what we have to focus on, right? It's not that the Christian faith makes your material circumstances wonderful. Rather, it's supposed to fortify you to be at peace no matter what your circumstances. If you want to build the kind of emotional resilience and virtue and fortitude into the soul so that I, like St. Paul, can be content in any circumstance, it is essential that you accustom to yourself to the idea of the worst. You have to confront the possibility of intense suffering so that you can deal with it when it comes. Because the goal is that if martyrdom were to come my way, if abnegation, if starvation, if nakedness, if toil, if social rejection comes my way, I need to be in a place where I can say, not my will, but thine be done.
Mm-hmm.
Be it done to me according to thy word. All these things I count as rubbish, you know, compared to the glory of knowing Jesus. I need to be able to say that. I won't be in that position if I haven't, as Jesus has admonished me to do, counted the cost and prepared my soul with interior acts of faith, hope, and charity, piety, fortitude, and the rest. The reason Catholics focus on the suffering of Christ is so that we will be capable of enduring the suffering of the cross when it comes our way. And for most people, you know, if no suffering has come into your life, well, blessed are you.
Mm.
Most people have some pretty heavy crosses that they have to deal with.
Yeah.
And you know, and you've met people who deal with them by collapsing, and you've met others who are able to function quite joyfully.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't do it by ignoring the fact of suffering, but by confronting it manfully and looking at it in the face and saying, yes, I can do this with God's help.
Parsivians, thank you so much for your call today. Call to Communion here on EWTN. We have a couple lines open for you at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. Brian is a first-time caller from Columbus, Ohio, listening on the great St. Gabriel Radio. Hey there, Brian. What's on your mind today, sir?
Thanks for taking my call, guys. Just a question about heaven and paradise. If this is a state of being where all our wants and needs are satisfied, the very few people we know that are actually in that state, Satan, Adam, and Eve, it wasn't good enough for them. They weren't satisfied. How could that be?
Yeah, okay, so the premise of the question is wrong. The Catholic position, the Catholic teaching is not that Satan and Adam enjoyed the blessed vision of heaven. They did not. Satan was never in the heaven of the saints, never in the heaven of the blessed. Neither was Adam. The reward of the just is what we call the beatific vision. Satan and Adam did not experience the beatific vision, ever. Right? Well, Adam maybe, but Satan never. Mm. So Satan literally didn't know what he was missing out on. Now, the righteous angels, this is the teaching of the church, the righteous angels, once they passed the moral test that Satan failed, at that point they were immediately confirmed in grace and admitted to the beatific vision. But they had an experience of glory that the devil has never had and never will.
Okay. Is that helpful for you, Brian?
Yeah, it's not enough. Thank you.
There you go. Appreciate your call. It's called a communion here on EWTN. Let's go to Michael in Albany, New York, listening on Sirius XM, channel 130. Michael, what's on your mind today, sir?
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, doctor. I'm looking at Colossians 1, verse 15, and I'm trying to respond to a Jehovah's Witness friend where it says, he, meaning Jesus, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. That's the part that I'm working on, the firstborn of all creation.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it. So the term firstborn here could refer to a creation in time. You know, the way when I have a child, there's a time before which my child does not exist, and then suddenly I have a child, and he's my first child, and then I go on to have subsequent ones. Or it could refer to the legal status that the firstborn has in the household as the heir of everything that belongs to the father. Guess which one of those is the right one? It's the second one. Mm. It's the second one. That the Christ's status as firstborn is as the legal heir to everything that belongs to the Father. All that the Father has is mine, so to speak. And so this has really no relevance in the dispute between Jehovah's Witnesses and Catholics about the eternity of the Son. And for that, we would go to other texts of Scripture, like the prologue to John's Gospel, mm-hmm. that tells us in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God, and He was with God from the beginning, and all things were made by Him, and in Him, and through Him, etc. So, yeah, Colossians 1 is just not on point with this particular issue.
Okay. Michael, thanks so much for your call. Here's a question from Mike. He was made sin for us. That quote comes from 2 Corinthians. Since the church does not endorse penal substitution, what does St. Paul mean here?
Yeah, so many commentators, and myself included, think that Paul is using shorthand for a sin offering, that he was made a sin offering. Now, sin offering is a technical term from Levitical law. It's a kind of sacrifice that was made in the temple. Mm-hmm. And other places, Paul refers to Jesus as a sacrifice of atonement. So he did not become personally sinful. He didn't have sin imputed to him. Rather, he gave his life as a sin offering.
Mike goes on to say, is made sin just a way of saying became man?
Exegetes can differ. I mean, if you uh-huh. want to take that position, I'd have to think through that and read a whole bunch of commentaries on it. I mean, the position I'm putting forth is that Paul asserts that Christ became a sin offering.
There you go. Mike, thanks so much for your email. And if you would like to send us an email for a future show, especially if you're watching on TV today, here's the address, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. In a moment, we'll talk with Taylor in St. Louis, Paul in Georgia, Adriana in Texas. A couple lines open for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986 for Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders right here on EWTN. It's called a communion here on EWTN. Busy phones today. We're going to try to get to as many people as we can in the last half of the program. Here is Taylor now, a first-time caller from St. Louis, listening on the Great Covenant Network. Hey there, Taylor. What's on your mind today?
Hi there, first-time caller. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm an RCIA currently, and I also have a friend who is an RCIA. I discovered that they identify as trans. They are born a man, but they identify and dress as a woman. And I don't believe that the parish is aware of this. And so I'm very torn between, you know, not wanting a perversion to come upon the Catholic Church, but at the same time, I don't want to inhibit anyone from becoming Catholic. So I was not sure what the right thing to do here in the situation was.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks. And look, we're kind of shooting from the hip here because this is a moving target in culture, and I think the church is still working on its pastoral response. And in fact, I happened to read this morning that that the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith is soon to come out with a new document on human dignity that, among other things, is going to address these issues of transsexualism and transgenderism. So we're going to get guidance from the magisterium, I think, soon on these issues that will clarify. So here are some initial thoughts. First of all, there's a difference between wanting to join the church and then wanting to attempt a sacrament for which proper sexual identity is essential for the valid celebration of the sacrament. So, for example, if this person is a man who claims to be a woman and attempted to contract a marriage to a man in a Catholic church, right, that is definitely something that the pastor of the church should know about, right, before he would go and perform that putative sacrament. If you had a woman who presented as a man and attempted ordination, that's absolutely something that the bishop would need to know about beforehand, so they wouldn't perform that sacrament. Now, what I would really hope is that this individual, everyone who goes to who presents himself to become Catholic, if they're an already baptized person, will of course have to go to confession before they receive confirmation. If they haven't been baptized, they won't be the case. But if this person's baptized, many people are, they'll have to go to confession. And I really hope if the person is operating in good faith, maybe in ignorance, but in good faith, that this person will make a kind of clean sweep of things in the confessional and divulge what needs to be divulged. This is the inner form, the interior form, as opposed to the external form, and that's where this really should take place. It has to be handled with pastoral sensitivity, right?
Sure.
And you could make a move right here. Yeah, you might succeed in stopping something, but you might also succeed in alienating somebody from the church and losing an opportunity for there to be a pastoral intervention.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be really delicate. I really hesitate to give a concrete advice. I mean, here is a thought, but take this with a grain of salt. You know, definitely wouldn't say anything in the context of the OCIA class. Definitely wouldn't do that. Not need kind of public forum. Might say something to the pastor privately without even using names about, you know, hey, you know, there might be this situation arising in the OCIA class. Just want to give you a heads up because it might be something you want to address in instruction in an anonymous but public way to say, hey, you know, just so you know, here's what the church is teaching is on a whole range of human sexual issues. And, you know, when you go to confession, you know, be properly prepared, et cetera, and give this person an opportunity to bring these things up in the privacy of that interior forum. But whatever you do, make sure you do it with deep sensitivity and love and charity.
Sure. Taylor, thanks so much for your call, and thank you for your concern for your friend. It's called a communion here on EWTN. Let's go to Paul now in Georgia, listening on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today, sir?
Good afternoon. How are you gentlemen today?
We're doing great. How are you, Paul?
Doing okay. A beautiful day here in Georgia. My question is, in relation to the gospel reading this last Sunday, I heard a reflection on the gospel from one of my daily emails I get on reflections on the readings. And it was said that, you know, the Pharisees felt they were doing the will of God. And we can kind of see this in bigger, broader section. And but they weren't. And Jesus is continually, you know, admonishing them for not doing the will of God. But they thought they were. How do we know, as Catholics, as Christians, that we are doing the will of God, that our church is doing the will of God?
Oh, great question. Great question. Fantastic question. Love this question. Thank you so much. So, you are correct that it is possible to adhere to a religious, or for that matter, a non-religious ideology, and to do so really dogmatically, but quite sincerely, to be utterly convinced in one's mind that one is doing the right thing, when in fact one is doing the wrong thing. And this is not limited to religious people, but, you know, take, for example, the really ideologically committed dogmatic communist who is willing to, as Stalin said, break quite a few eggs in pursuit of the utopian dream, right, that's never going to happen, and do unbelievable harm to persons and to society. How do we assess the moral status of a person like that? Well, you know, the Pharisees, this is where their situation. They were tithing mint, dill, and cumin, Jesus said, but they were neglecting the weightier matters of the law, like love and justice and faithfulness. So how do we probably can't guarantee that we ourselves will never become ideologically possessed or in love with a theory that actually distorts the human good or human flourishing. That's probably going to happen to all of us to some degree at some point in our lives. Seems to me the antidote for that is what St. Thomas calls docility. It is to maintain an attitude of teachableness. And it's one thing to hold a theory. It's another thing to hold it so dogmatically that I will not listen to any potential defeaters.
Mm. Yeah.
And so I think that rationality is not about, and rationality is really the seat of our morality. Rationality is not about always getting the right answer. To my judgment, rationality is about always being able to self-correct when you're presented with contrary evidence. Having the humility to say, you know, that's a point of view I never considered before, or that evidence contradicts my position. You know, I need to re-examine my position, to consider myself not the God's gift to the universe on, you know, tax policy or hand washing or modes of communion or whatever it might be, to have that attitude of docility. You know, Karl Popper, the famous philosopher of science, his whole view on the way science works, the verification principle was that you try to falsify, right? The whole idea of science is you don't ever really arrive at the absolute truth. You just keep perfecting your theories by falsifying and falsifying and falsifying, finding conditions under which it doesn't work, and then qualify. Now, you know, Thomas Kuhn, who gives us a completely different philosophy of science, thought that would never break you ultimately out of a wrong paradigm. You could refine a paradigm, but you wouldn't ultimately break out of it. But you can be challenged by a completely different paradigm, right? Two scientists have completely different explanatory frameworks, both of which, you know, get somewhat at the truth. And one of those is going to just have wider scope than the other. That's another way of challenging your presuppositions, right? You may have a theory that seems to explain absolutely everything in your experience, and there's no holes in it at all that you can find. And then voila, you find a whole nother universe over here that you never considered before that your theory doesn't even touch, right? And but whatever the nature of the challenge, whether it's a kind of empirical falsification a la Karl Popper, or if it's a completely different explanatory paradigm a la Thomas Kuhn, that willingness to be challenged and to say, maybe I don't know everything, right? And that docility and openness to persuasion. I mean, this is why in the Platonic tradition, and I'm sorry to bring in all these philosophers, but we're talking about philosophical issues here. In the Platonic tradition, the key spiritual practice is something called dialectic. And it's the opposite of rhetoric. Rhetoric is, I'm going to persuade you that I'm right. And dialectic is, you and I take contrary positions, not because I know I'm right and you're wrong, but in the idea that if we take different sides of an issue and we are both striving together to arrive at first principles, to arrive at truths, then our opposition is actually productive of helping each of us attain a truth that we can't get to on our own. And the empirical data on this, the scientific literature on sort of collective intelligence is always that it's better than the individual genius.
A conversation rather than a lecture.
Exactly. And the way Catholic theology developed in the Middle Ages was by embracing dialectic. I mean, if you look at St. Thomas's Summa, for example, the way he functions is not, hey, I'm going to tell you the absolute truth. It's rather he poses a question, and he'll say, you know, can it be known that God exists? And he'll say, well, it would seem not. And he'll give you all the reasons why it seems like we can't know that God exists. Well, but against that, on the other hand, there are these other arguments. And then what he does, he doesn't just go through and knock down the objections. He actually tries to incorporate his antagonist's positions into his final conclusion. You know, his final response is never just a restatement of the Catholic position. It's an elaboration. It's an enrichment that's been enriched precisely because of his openness to dialogue with other traditions. So in the case of Thomas specifically, Thomas, at the time of St. Thomas Aquinas, the big challenge philosophically to Catholicism was Averroism. It was Arabian necessitarian philosophy. It was an Arabian interpretation of Aristotle. And up until Thomas, there were two views of that in the Catholic tradition. There were the Averroists that just said, hey, Averroes is right and the Catholic tradition is wrong. We need to just switch, right? Then there were radical Augustinians that said, anything pagan is bad. We're going to throw him out. We're not going to listen to anything Averroes has to say. Here comes Thomas and he says, you're both wrong. We can learn things from this other tradition, right? And it can enrich our Catholicism without us fundamentally changing our religious identity. And then that's why Pope Leo XIII said Thomas Aquinas is the ideal theologian. He's the ideal philosopher because he's not just a dogmatist. He's not just a fundamentalist. But neither is he just going to go wholesale into another paradigm.
Yeah.
He has this ability to be docile, to bring different traditions into conversation, and hopefully learn from the process.
Paul, thanks so much for your call. There's a lot to unpack there. And if you want to listen again, go to the podcast. You'll find it at ewtn.com/radio. Once you're on the radio homepage, go over to where it says Podcast Central. Then you want to scroll down a little bit. Those are all in alphabetical order. So you'll see Call to Communion toward the top of the page. Thanks again for your call. Don't forget, on EWTN Radio, each and every Monday through Friday, you can check out Cresta in the Afternoon with author, lecturer, a longtime Catholic radio stalwart, Al Cresta. What a wonderful program. Al and his guests talk about today's news and the things that matter most. And these days, that's really what we have time for. Let's take care of the things that matter the most. You'll find it on Al Cresta's Cresta in the Afternoon. Wednesday are weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern right here on EWTN, on the radio side of EWTN. Let's go now to Adriana, a first-time caller from Texas, listening on the Guadalupe Radio app. Adriana, what's on your mind today?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Last year, my family and I visited Barcelona, Spain, and my niece was actually on a mission over there. She's Protestant. But me being Catholic, I was just amazed by everything there, the churches. And, you know, she's pretty open to dialogue, and I talked a lot about my faith with her. And you know, there were some eye-opening things that she didn't know about our faith. So one day I decided I wanted to go visit the churches over there. One of them was like a museum in the early afternoon. So she went with me, and we were looking at all the paintings. There was a particular painting of St. Francis of Assisi. I don't know if it was it was St. Francis resurrecting a little girl. And we looked at it, and she said, well, I don't understand. I mean, you know that only God is the only one that can resurrect, that can bring, you know, a person back to life. Nobody else can. And I know that to be, you know, something I believe. And at that moment, I was just, I did not have an answer to her. The best thing I said to her, well, it wasn't really him doing it. You know, obviously, it's God doing it. But the fact that it said on the painting, St. Francis was the one that resurrected this little girl.
Yeah, I can speak to that.
I felt like it wasn't a sufficient answer that I gave her.
I can speak to that. I really appreciate the question. So this is your Protestant relative who is objecting to the idea that Catholic saints could perform miracles. So I would point your Protestant relative to a passage of sacred scripture, in particular the book of Acts chapter 9, verses 36 to 42. In this, there was a woman named Tabitha, also called Dorcas, who was a pious Christian woman, and she died. And her friends and neighbors were mourning this, and they brought it to the attention of St. Peter. And Peter went into the room where the corpse was lying, and he sent everybody else away. And the text tells us he got down on his knees and he prayed. And then he turned to the body and said, "Tabitha, get up." And she opened her eyes and looked at Peter and sat up and walked away.
Wow.
So having prayed, God gave Peter the authority to command a dead person to get up and walk, and they did, and he raised him from the dead. That is what stories about St. Francis depict happening, that he did something that is not different than what God permitted the apostles to do. Now, you're correct that the power to do that comes from God, right? But it came in response to prayer, and at least the way sacred scripture depicts it, it was a kind of delegated authority where Peter could speak in the name of God to a corpse, and it would obey him, but because of the authority that God had ceded to him, right, for this one occasion.
Sure, sure.
Something similar could very well have happened in the life of St. Francis.
All right. Adriana, thanks so much for your call from Texas today. Got a little praise report for you, David. This came from Bella watching us on YouTube. Bella says, "Love how you tell a story of the Bible in today's language."
Oh, well, appreciate that.
Isn't that nice? That was from something earlier that you were quoting. You were kind of,
I didn't say thee, thy, and thou.
No, you did not, and I appreciate that. Thank you. Here's a question also from John watching us on YouTube today. You have stated that Catholic doctrine is that we can predicate divinity of Christ in any aspect or action, since he is a divine person. But if God died, does that not make him mutable?
No, because God had a human nature.
Okay.
God had a human nature.
Well, there it is. Appreciate that. John, thanks for watching us on YouTube today. Here is Gary now, a first-time caller in Billings, Montana, listening on the great Billings Catholic Radio. Gary, what's on your mind today, sir?
Well, I hope I'm calling the right program, but weren't you earlier talking about On This Rock?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, good. Seems to me, I went back and refreshed my memory. Preceding that statement, it says, basically, blessed are you because you've heard this from my father. And I know it's kind of far-fetched, but do you think it's possible that that was the rock? That was a confirmation that Jesus was looking for from his father, that he made Simon perceive this.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. If that's the case, then I would say St. Matthew is a really terrible writer, right? If that was his intent, he's a really terrible. Let me just read the passage to you, and I'll read a little bit more so we can bring that in.
Sure.
But Jesus said to them, "Who do you say that I am?" And Simon Peter said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Jesus said to him, "Simon, son of Jonah, you are happy because you did not learn this from man. My Father in heaven has shown you this. And I tell you that you are Peter. You are rock. You are rock, and on this rock I will build my church." If the rock to which Jesus refers is in fact the fact that God revealed this information to Peter, then, like I say, Matthew has got to be one of the worst prose stylists in the history of human literature. Because there's nothing in the text itself that even suggests, let alone warrants, such an interpretation. Have people wanted to interpret the text that way? Yes, but for strictly theological reasons, not exegetical ones.
Okay. Gary, thanks so much for your call from Billings today. Chike is watching us on YouTube today. Chike says, "Did Paul contradict Jesus on faith and grace?"
Not at all. 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 Paul says, well, first of all, what does Jesus say about it? Jesus says very little about grace. The term grace almost never appears in the Gospels, right? It does it a little bit in John, but virtually none at all in Matthew, Mark, and Luke.
Okay.
The sort of the sum and substance of Jesus' teaching is that the kingdom of God is coming, buddy, and you better shape up. Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is here. And then a lot of his teaching is a description of what the ethical life is like that qualifies you for entrance into the kingdom of heaven. And of course, the pinnacle of that, the culmination of that, is Matthew 25, when he says on the last day, when the Son of Man is judging the nations, many people will come and say, Lord, Lord, and he'll say, away from me, I never knew you, because you didn't feed the hungry, clothe the naked, give drink to the thirsty, etc. But those who did these things will be welcomed into the kingdom of my Father. So, I mean, that is the sum and substance of Jesus' teaching. Now, does Paul contradict that? On the contrary, St. Paul says in Romans chapter 2, verse 13, it's not those who hear the law, it is those who obey the law who will be declared righteous. And Galatians chapter 5, if you go back to fornication and adultery and hatred and factions and jealousy and disobedience to parents and carousing and drunkenness and the like, you will not inherit the kingdom of God. But if you walk in the Spirit, have the fruits of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, you know, self-control and so forth, then you will inherit the kingdom of God. Christ, St. Paul's teaching is thoroughly ethical from start to finish. It has the exact same message as Jesus, that we have to purify ourselves of everything that contaminates flesh or spirit out of reverence for God, 2 Corinthians 7:1, and that the sum and substance of the law is that we love God above all things and love our neighbor as ourselves, Romans 13:8, and that we can do that with the help of grace, that God pours his love into our hearts, that's Romans 5:5, enabling us, in fact, to keep the righteous requirements of the law. And you find that in Romans chapter 2, verses 25 to 29. So what Paul does is he gives you a deeply theological elaboration of the teaching of Jesus. Jesus sort of gives you the straightforward ethical commands, and Paul explains how that actually takes place with the help of the Holy Spirit. But there's a perfect continuity, in my mind, between the teaching of St. Paul and Jesus on this issue.
Very good. And Chike, thanks so much for checking in today via YouTube. Also on YouTube today is Aaron, who says, I'm thinking about leaving the church, but not sure if it's boredom or what. What should I do?
Yeah, don't leave the church.
There you go.
Yeah, that was easy. That was easy. Yeah, thinking about it, lots of people think about it, just don't do it, right?
Yeah.
And perhaps you're bored, right? Well, if you're bored, that's fantastic. That means that we've finally gotten past the honeymoon, you know, candy-coated, sugar-coated part of being a Catholic, and we've gotten down to the hard work of trying to work on the virtues, right?
Yeah.
And perseverance and fortitude and the rest of them. Now, if your Catholic faith is limited to your liturgical observances on Sunday, maybe that was okay up until now. Obviously, no longer okay. Mm-hmm. No longer okay. So go get yourself a spiritual director and take up spiritual practices. You know, maybe go on an Ignatian retreat or something.
Mm-hmm.
Start digging into the interior life, which is the sum and substance of the Catholic faith. At the end of the day, it's about what happens in your inner world. You cannot possibly be bored if you are genuinely engaged in the pursuit of an interior life and the life of virtue. I mean, that will give you business to keep you occupied from now until you die or kingdom come, I promise you. Start reading the spiritual literature of the church. Read Teresa. That's Teresa of Avila, of course, John of the Cross. Read Augustine. Read St. Francis de Sales. Get a hold of some modern writers like Jacques Philippe or Thomas Dubay, Story of a Soul, Thérèse of Lisieux. Start putting this stuff into practice. I promise you, you will not be bored. You'll have work to last you the rest of your life.
So I became a Catholic in 1992. And to me, that honeymoon period, as soon as you said that phrase, I thought, I know exactly what he's talking about. And you went through that as well, right?
Sure. Yeah, everyone does. Everyone does. And you need to get through that as fast as possible. Go ahead and hit the 7-year itch of Catholicism, because now you can start getting some work done. Right now, you can actually start working on the. I mean, when you're just living on fumes like that, you get a lot of activity. You do a lot of stuff, but you're so enamored with the accoutrements of Catholic life that you don't really necessarily penetrate down into the depths of the work on yourself that you need to do.
I remember going through a Curcio weekend, as many people have done, and I remember one of the people there said, "It's not just about the Catholic stuff." There again, I knew exactly what he was talking about.
You know, St. Augustine says in his book on Christian doctrine that the entire universe exists for one purpose, and that is ultimately to bring us to the love of God and neighbor. That everything else is just window dressing.
Great show today. Dr. David Andrews, thank you, sir.
Thanks, Tom.
We do this program Monday through Friday right here on EWTN. On the radio side, you'll hear it at 2 p.m. Eastern Monday through Friday. Check out the podcast, as we were talking about earlier, by going to EWTN.com/radio, then click on the words Podcast Central. Along with Call to Communion, you'll find, I believe, about 100 wonderful Catholic podcasts. So do check that out, EWTN.com/radio, then look for Podcast Central. On behalf of our fantastic team here, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Andrews. Hey, thanks for checking us out today. Hope to see you next time right here on EWTN's Call to Communion. Have a wonderful day and God bless.